Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And I'd like to welcome to the program today Wayne Quistenbaum. He's written a book called Humiliation. He joins us by telephone from Manhattan, perhaps?
Yes, sweaty Manhattan.
We're sweaty out here in Ohio, too. How are you today?
Well, other than the aforementioned sweaty, I'm cheerfully awaiting the official publication of my book, which is August 2nd.
And we will be airing this interview right after the book comes out.
Wonderful.
So none of us will feel humiliated about that.
No.
Humiliation. How? Why? Where? Wherefore? Where are you going?
How did this happen? Honestly, the honest, I could make up an answer, but the honest answer is that I'm a teacher at the City University of New York in the PhD program of English, and every year I have to come up with new classes. And a few years ago, in search for a fetching rubric for a seminar, I came up with the notion of humiliation. I thought, why not teach a class called Humiliation? It's a catchy title. The students will think, of course, that they will be humiliated by taking the course, or they will be reminded that education is itself always a little humiliating. But nonetheless, we will read books that feature scenes of humiliation or works of theory that try to explain the emotional process of being humiliated. And I taught this course twice, and there was always an amazing sense of solidarity in the room, because our contract with each other was that we would never try to humiliate or embarrass or shame each other. And so there was a really egalitarian, cathartic atmosphere. It was an anti-humiliation workshop. So, and then I wrote the book based on the things that I came up with during the process of teaching this class. And also I started keeping a humiliation scrapbook, largely based on my daily reading of the New York Times.
You're charting other people's humiliation then, like, say, when Senator Larry Craig had that little problem in the bathroom?
Yes. Indeed, problems like Larry Craig's in the bathroom are my specialty. Okay. As a writer, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I've always been amused, horrified, filled with pity by the spectacle of such scenes.
Mm.
So, yeah, definitely it was this. It was a wish to stand up for the Larry Craigs of the world that prompted me to write this book.
And I'm sure you were probably distraught that the book had already gone to press when Congressman Weiner joined that famed parade of embarrassment.
Yes, I know, but he would certainly have been, if not the star of the book, he would have been a player along with Elliot Spitzer and Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And the aforementioned Larry Craig. Yes, yes. Anthony Weiner, is that how you say his name? Weiner?
Well, I'm calling him Weiner just to be nice.
I am too. It's tough. It's a tough name. Anthony Weiner has all of my support, I must say, because my feeling with about a figure like Anthony Weiner is that it's just always distressing for me as a private citizen to be placed in the position of watching somebody else's humiliation. Mm. And he was humiliated for doing something that, if you were not a public figure, would be within the bounds of legal and, kind of within the bounds of it's his own business. And when we stumble across a scene like the shaming of Anthony Weiner in the press, we become like playground bullies. We may not be the one who instigates the bully, but we're watching the scene. And this is not to say that the people who are, the Larry Craigs of the world or the Anthony Weiners, that they're always good people or that they always have acted ethically. That's not the issue. The issue is, for me, our becoming complicit as viewers and readers with the bullies.
Well, a lot of us derive enjoyment from humiliation, and I confess that when I read the end of your book and you had that listing of all these humiliations that you remembered and suffered over the years from your earliest memories, I chuckled, I laughed, and I felt ashamed of myself for doing so. But as you point out in the book, humiliation is popular. Humiliation is big. Look at American Idol.
Yeah, and you know, I must say that the effect of that last chapter, deliberate or unconscious, I don't know, is that for me to take those scenes, mostly from the past, that had embarrassed or shamed me, and by rendering them with a kind of clarity and brevity and economy, making them a little funny. Even though, again, as I told you, I didn't laugh when I wrote that chapter, I know from my years and years of writing that the effect of me putting down my embarrassing memories is to produce laughter in others, and that's a kind of cathartic, reparative effect.
My favorite line in that chapter is where you say, "I threw away my fax machine."
I'm so glad I didn't cut that line.
I love that.
I'm really, really glad. You should. I wish you had. You could have made me very happy. You've made me happy today, but if you had telephoned me a year ago when I was writing, when I was thinking about cutting that line, I would have been happy. Yeah, no, that's a, you know, because, as you know, I say in that chapter, I remember a bad review curling out of my fax machine. Then a few years later, I remember another bad review of a book of mine curling out of my fax machine because I used that really lousy paper, the shiny paper. And then, indeed, I threw away my fax machine. I still get bad reviews, as all writers do, and they're still horrifying to receive. I don't think reviewers fully understand. I wonder if reviewers fully understand the emotional impact on the writer of an uncharitable review.
Wayne Kustenbaum joins us. His book is Humiliation. It's just being published by Picador, and he joins us today by telephone from sweltering Manhattan. You made me think when I read this book. There were so many different tangents. Of course, I thought of my own personal humiliations over the years, but you made me think when you say things like humiliation is a kiln through which the human soul passes.
Yes,
we're being tempered, we're being forged, we're being melted. Explain.
That may sound a little Puritan of me, like, you know, the early American Puritans, and maybe I am secretly a Puritan, but I believe, and I borrow this idea in a way from Oscar Wilde, that the experience of being shamed, being pilloried, is a kind of trial by fire for the soul, and that if one can survive it, one emerges refined, spiritually refined. I don't wish such experiences on anyone. I certainly don't wish them on myself, and I pray that I don't have to necessarily experience this refinement. I don't want to go into that kiln, but in my own way, I have. It's just as a human being, I've had my humiliations, and I've experienced a little bit of that Oscar Wilde effect. That sense of consolidation, and that's as if you feel that nothing, everything is being taken away from you, and there's maybe just a little shred of you left, but that shred starts to feel very solid and golden.
We are, I think, contemporaries. I think you're probably just a few years younger than I am, and I really sympathize with you when you describe a particular humiliation. I'm guessing this would have happened in the early 70s when you were in eighth grade, and you went out on a date, and you were mistaken for a girl.
Yeah, because, you know, I am still very petite, small, thin, slight. I had long, curly hair emulating the hippies. I'm sure I wore flowered shirts and love beads or whatever. You know, I wasn't really thinking of trying to fit into gender roles very much at that age. And I lived in a somewhat, gender-wise, a very inflexible time. Where, you know, I mean, I didn't live in a big city where there was maybe more plasticity and play around gender roles, so that it felt to me like a repeated failure to seem legibly boyish as a kid very much shaped my sense of what it means to be in public and to face other people.
I thought of Harold Bloom when you talked about Shakespeare and how Shakespeare humiliated the English language. And this really took me off on a tangent. I've interviewed Dr. Bloom a couple of times, and I thought to myself, I wonder what Harold Bloom would have to say about your statement about Shakespeare.
Well, God, I don't ever want to know what Harold Bloom would have to say. I mean, you know, I think he's obviously a tremendously influential and erudite and really a phenomenal critic, but our sensibilities are very different, to say the least. And what I don't think I mean something that different from what Harold Bloom meant when he talked about the anxiety of influence, because he was, I think, in his theory, he meant that writers, the greatest writers like Shakespeare, are aggressive. Bloom would have argued, I don't know if he would have said this about Shakespeare, but certainly he would have said about Shelley and others, Wordsworth, that poets are aggressive or even patricidal toward earlier poets. Mm. And what I'm saying when saying that Shakespeare humiliated the language, I'm saying that Shakespeare is patricidal toward language itself, and that the opulence of his gift almost seems to function as a kind of violence that he's doing to English, which before Shakespeare came along, English was nothing. You know, Shakespeare created English, mm-hmm. virtually, and you can. I can feel that in every line, practically the muscularity of his invention and invigorating of language. And when you combine that with the fact that he's often describing in his greatest moments the suffering of his characters or the grandiosity of his characters, I begin to feel that language itself is a player in this drama.
And Shakespeare wrote with tremendous confidence, yet you say you don't really like confident literature.
No, well, I understand I like aphorisms. I like generalities. I like saying something is always something. That's just that's maybe, again, the influence of Oscar Wilde. I like saying preposterous things that are somewhat true and that have a kind of momentary truth, and that's a kind of part of my style. Mm. And so indeed, when I say I don't like confident literature, you know, that's 75% true. I don't like... I like to feel for my favorite writers, I like to feel that there was for those writers an undertow of shame for them in the process of writing or of being published. And, you know, to take somebody, let's say T.S. Eliot would be a good example of an in-between character, where you could certainly say T.S. Eliot was plenty confident, but from Prufrock on, his literature is also filled with a sense of an awareness of its own impoverishment. Mm. And it's that Eliot that I respond to with such feeling.
Wayne Kustenbaum joins us. His new book is Humiliation. Let's talk a little bit about the humiliation triangle. It's three things: tyrant, victim, witness. Explain.
Yeah, that's how I see it. It seems to me that if there's not a witness, we have shame, we have physical pain, we have many things, but it's the presence of that third party that makes the experience truly humiliation. So humiliation is a drama that needs a stage, that implies a stage. And on that stage, there is a tyrant, an oppressor, and on that stage is also a victim, the one who suffers. And the third party is us. You know, we and the spectator in the audience watching this, and maybe we will function as the messenger and bring the bad news elsewhere. Again, like all of my statements, is this absolutely true? Has this always been true throughout history? I don't know. But it seems to me that even if we look at Cain and Abel, or just some of the early biblical stories or myths, there's the suffering comes from it's being witnessed by somebody else. And in my own life, that's what makes a scene of shame or humiliation so wrenching.
And as we look back through history, whether we're looking at the Bible or we're looking at something like the rise of Hitler, mm-hmm. humiliation was an integral part of that. The humiliation that Hitler and that many Germans felt because of the Versailles Treaty after World War I in many ways led to the monstrosity that occurred in World War II.
Yes, and again, I'm not a historian, and I can't say that I understand the cause and effect of such things, but it seems to me, I've heard it alleged, that it was Germany's sense of defeat and humiliation after World War I that was one of the factors that led to the production of this other kind of this monstrous grandiosity and sense of divine destiny. and a tremendous will to scapegoat and shame and murder others. I mean, it's really, to Nazi Germany is obviously a kind of a limit case of a state gone absolutely wild and evil, but you do see there an operation that involves systematically humiliating just about everyone.
And you also make the point that in a world where we have so much artificiality around us, that humiliation is real.
Yeah, it's a funny point to say humiliation is real, and that's why I respect it, and that's why I wanted to write about it. But there's a lot of simulation in our world and a lot of fake thrills, and I succumb to them and I produce them, you know, kind of a caffeinated sensibility, a sense of inebriation in the trend of the moment, or just quotidian excitements. But when you experience humiliation or witness humiliation, there is a rock bottom truth to that moment that has a kind of awful grandeur, even a sublimity, because it's really true. It's really happening. It's what I imagine to be like the moment of death, or certainly a moment of great physical pain. The experience of extreme pain, I imagine, and I to some extent have experienced, is one of inescapable reality and presentness.
When I look back, this book made me look back a lot and think about those moments when I felt humiliated, and many of them happened in school. And I'm wondering, is it possible to have an education without humiliation? You asked that question in the book.
I wonder if it is. I don't know if it is. I mean, I think it's a miracle that so many of us get through school. And I think that if I knew then what I know now, I probably would have dropped out of school. You know, I'm glad I didn't. But what kept me going was a great belief in authority, and a great fear of punishment, and a great desire to measure up and to excel. And that kept me disciplined. But whenever I know, I don't have children, but I many of my friends do, and some of them have problems in school or want to drop out, and I always sympathize. I always understand. Why would you want to do that assignment? Why would you want to go to school if you feel that, you know, half the class is making fun of you? It's tough. I don't know if homeschooling is no better. That's worse, it seems to me, because humiliation begins in the home. And to have school often represents an escape from the humiliations of being a child at home. So, and it's not like being employed means an escape from humiliation. It's not like when school is over and you need to get a job, there isn't plenty of humiliation. There, humiliation is sadly inescapable, but I think the more we notice that the effects of our actions may be the humiliation of others, maybe there's some good there in instigating that kind of self-consciousness.
Wayne Kustenbaum joins us. We're talking about his new book, Humiliation. And I really connected with you on a lot of levels in a lot of your litany of humiliations in that final chapter of the book. I write book reviews, and I wrote one recently for a book that I really admire and a writer who I truly admire. And I know he didn't like the review. And I was reading yours, and you said, quote, "Recently, I wrote a commissioned essay about a painter. The curator told me that the painter was upset by my essay and that it would be pulled from the catalog." I'm sorry. I can't help laughing.
It's so true. I don't make anything up. I did not make that up. Yeah. And of course, you know, in a situation like that, I think, oh my God, maybe I was too cavalier in my essay and I did take all these liberties. And I know I do take a lot of liberties in my writing, and I use, I let fantasy have free play, you know, whatever. But I can't imagine, though, in the incident that you're saying, if you admired the book and wrote a positive review, how could the writer not be pleased? Unless the writer is very fussy or very neurasthenic, or is used to such unmitigated praise that any kind of faint criticisms you might have let in were wounding.
You know, he's not fussy at all, and I think the problem was, he was getting big reviews in the New York Times and other big publications, and mine was in the Dayton Daily News, and I don't know, maybe he just didn't feel like it was good enough. But speaking of that, I was at a personal humiliation I'd like to share that I think you'd enjoy. I was at a party at Book Expo a number of years ago in Washington, and it was the New Yorker party. And I was chatting with David Remnick, and I was just really enjoying myself. I had a cocktail. I was eating hors d'oeuvres. Robert Siegel from NPR walked by and took a shrimp off the plate, and I just felt like I was on top of the world, and it was very noisy. And this woman came up to me who was a very prominent agent. I recognized her name. And she came up to me, and she goes, "Oh, who are you?" And she's talking to me, and we didn't have name tags on, but someone had said her name. And I said, "I'm Vic McCunis, and I write book reviews for the Dayton Daily News." And she got all excited, and we started having this chat, and she kept asking me about the Daily News, the Daily News, the Daily News. And I thought, oh, okay, she thinks I mean the New York Daily News. And when I clarified that it was the Dayton Daily News, she looked at me with a look of complete shock and just turned around and walked away.
Oh, my God. That is classic New York literary world humiliation.
Oh, it was.
You know, my version of that is I will be at a party. Let's say it's one of those kind of book expo parties. I'm at a party and I'm talking to somebody who's, let's say, reasonably important or worthy of esteem, and somebody else walks in the room also worthy of esteem, and that person, I also know that person, and this person comes up to the two of us and looks straight through me, doesn't even see me, and begins a conversation with the person I'm talking to. And the experience of somebody that you know, somebody who's an acquaintance, looking right through you and not recognizing you, but just literally being so preoccupied with the bigger fish that are in the room that you feel you become invisible. That's so so humiliating. These are small humiliations. We're not talking about genocide or torture, and so it seems kind of bourgeois and narcissistic to dwell on them, but they're real. And it's the world that we live in, the world of literature and the dissemination of literature, is filled with this kind of daily humiliation. It's very humiliating to be a writer. It's humiliating to seek publication. It's kind of humiliating to be published.
And it's humiliating to be a politician.
It's all humiliating. So my book doesn't give any answers. It's really, an attempt to think through this issue and to offer a personal interpretation of it.
The book is Humiliation. Wayne Kustenbaum wrote it. He joins us in the Book Nook today. I went a little further afield after I finished the book because I was sort of ashamed, as I mentioned, that I'd been laughing at some of your humiliations there in the final chapter. And I thought, well, I need to feel better about myself. So I went to the Macmillan website and I saw some of these short little 2-minute videos that you made. And that reassured me that there's a big element of humor here, particularly with you. I really laughed when you did the email one.
Yes.
The embarrassing email, jellyroll@gmail.com.
Yes.
With email, we have so many opportunities to embarrass ourselves, don't we?
Yes, I really try in email never to say something negative about a third party because the email could get forwarded.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that. I mean, email is a very indiscreet medium. I'm pretty old fashioned, or a Luddite, I guess you would say. I'm not on Facebook. I was one of the last people to get on email. I wasn't on email until the 21st century, seriously. I was still using a typewriter until the 21st century. I'm not part of the culture of Facebook and the things like that. And largely it's because I imagine that they would be humiliating. I would assume that I wouldn't have as many friends as somebody else. And I would feel the wound. I would be, this isn't unique, but I am very sensitive to being slighted.
Well, Facebook provides many opportunities to feel slighted. And I think you're wise to avoid it.
The world of the internet is treacherous. And that's why there's so many stories, and I mentioned a couple of them in my book, so many stories these days in the news about email and Facebook bullying, even leading to suicide. It can be, if it's devastating for us, and look, we're seasoned citizens of the world, we're survivors, we're middle-aged. Think of what it's like for a 12 or 13-year-old who does not have that resilience or sense of perspective.
Hmm. Well, this book made me think. And I thank you for that.
Well, I thank you for laughing, and I thank you for identifying with me as you read the book.
The book is Humiliation. Wayne Kustenbaum wrote it. He's been our guest today on the program, and I think we have just enough time to talk about this series. It's called Big Ideas, Small Books. This book debuted in paperback, and this is a very interesting series.
Yeah, it is. They're I think, adorable little packages. They're the tiniest little books I've ever seen, practically, and they each have, you know, the series includes, some of the other titles are Bodies, The 1960s, Violence, and mine is Humiliation. So you take the idea in these books is to take a big term or a big concept and to render it friendly and digestible. And for me, as somebody who's primarily a poet and who works through metaphor and free association and autobiographical digression, it was a very inviting assignment to write a small book because I didn't have to pontificate or expatiate upon things. I could dance between ideas and present juxtapositions and paradoxes and cameos. And I like working in fragments, and the small book or the book-length essay is a form that really permits, licenses that kind of fragmentation. It's a very nice cover, I must say, too. It looks like one of those five-year diaries you had when you were a kid, but it's been chipped into by some kind of hacker's tool. So there's damage marks in the leatherette binding.
The Humiliation of the Found Diary.
Yes.
Well, it's really been a pleasure.
Thank you, for me too.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and our guest today has been Wayne Kustenbaum. His book is Humiliation. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Tune in again for the program as we welcome Lynn Cullen. She has written a new work of historical fiction. They never thought she would become queen. She was the third child of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain. Her name was Juana, and she did become queen, and it's a wild story. They called her Juana the Mad. We'll be talking to Lynn Cullen about Reign of Madness, her latest work of historical fiction. Tune in for the Book Nook next week, right here on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.